Ticket. It's time for the Kick Around, the Ticket's weekly show all about soccer. 2 hours of HSOs on the clubs, leagues, and tournaments of the world's game. It doesn't matter if you're new to the sport. Don't worry. This is the Ticket. We're just kicking it around. Now, our very own yellow and red card, Andy Swift and Peter Welpton.
Kolisic through the middle. Brought out beautifully. Then the check. Then the layoff. Then the goal. Aronson's name on it. Kolisic all over it. World class from Christian Pulisic to set up his teammate.
Hi to Hopi Ones, and welcome to today's Kick Around here on the Sport Radio 96.7 and 1310, The Ticket, where you, the good P1, sits around, talks some soccer and all that implies. Don't forget, you can find us on our website, thekickaround.com. Hi, it's me, Peter. Hope you are well and helping out, because he is my soccer talking BFF. And sitting here inside this broadcasting church, noted soccer expert, the one, the only, Andy Swift.
Helping out Peter hold court in the world of soccer.
Yes.
Is that what I do?
You are my soccer talking helper.
Let me assist you then. Are you having withdrawal from no league action?
It was, I actually spent a rare Saturday morning attending to a family, not chore, just thing I had to do.
You finally paid attention to family a little bit, huh? Now that soccer season's winding
like
down.
My family.
Oh. Huh.
Yes. Well, welcome to the show, everybody. I know people are wondering. We've been asked if we wanted to consider moving to the 12-2 slot. And Andy and I think we've decided that's probably not, while it would be good for our personal lives, not good for the radio program, because historically at 11:30 is the big Premier League game of the day, and that just seems like we're shooting ourselves in the foot trying to broadcast against that.
Right. Conversation pending still with the Premier League. We're pitching.
We're asking them if they would consider moving that 11:30 game for somewhere, you know, later in the afternoon, like push it to, you know, 2:30 or something like that. But anyway, that's what's going on. All right, today we got lots happening, including talking about some of these final World Cup qualifiers that are going to take place. The gigantic Wales-Ukraine game is tomorrow. By the way, they've moved that from ESPN2 to ESPN. Mm. I don't know if you knew that. They've finally figured out that that's a pretty significant matchup. There's that. Andy wants to go back and relive what he calls Real Madrid's magical season. So yeah, okay.
I thought you were going to say relive the final, but no, that's what I want. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Andy's decided he's going to give up his Liverpool fandom and hop on the Real Madrid bandwagon.
I just want to point out why Liverpool's fate was already sealed before they even played the game.
Okay. And we'll spend a couple of segments reviewing the rest of the Premier League season that we didn't get to last week. But first, we are now into that time of the year where we get to talk lots about the U.S. men's national team. Normally, in the cycle of things, right about now, we would all be deep into training for the World Cup.
We'd be 2 weeks away.
We would be so close to a World Cup. We'd be shivering and shaking.
These friendlies would be like the final tune-ups.
Yes, and we'd be like 6-year-old kids the 2 weeks before Christmas or whatever your holiday is at that time of year. You know what I mean? Like you're just
yes.
The anticipation
yes.
would be all. We'd all just be crazy, but no, we're not, because again, for those of you not paying attention, the World Cup is happening this year. It's just not happening until literally the week of Thanksgiving. So. In lieu of that, we're getting this confusing mess of international games that are either A, friendlies, B, qualifiers for the remaining few slots left to go to the World Cup, or C, these janky Nation League games that nobody cares about.
Right. Although, we'll be talking about how Nations League competitions might change, too.
Yes. Yeah, we can talk about that. So, the U.S. men's national team has now started. They played a game earlier this week against Morocco. We'll talk about that in a second. They play Uruguay. Is it tomorrow?
Yes.
Yeah, they play Uruguay tomorrow. Those two are friendly, kind of World Cup tune-up games against two other teams that are actually in the World Cup. And then, as I mentioned earlier, they've got two more games, which are just janky Nation League games, one against Grenada and the other one against El Salvador, which happened at the end of the week. But I want to talk a little bit about what happened against Morocco because, all right, I think Morocco is a national team.
Yes, they are. Good job.
That, depending on your point of view, I think Morocco is better than I think many people give them credit for. They had not lost a game in quite some time.
Correct. Morocco is not a current, not a bad current national team, and historically been one of the better teams out of Africa. Made several World Cups.
Weren't they the second team from Africa to qualify for the World Cup? Am I right about
that? I don't know if they were the second one because it all depends on timing. They're ranked number two in Africa.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
So second, you know, if you believe those rankings. But they're a decent side, and they also have to prepare for a World Cup. So they're going to take this friendly seriously as well. They're not going to be testing the young kids, things like that.
Right. And I'm not going to claim to be a Morocco national team expert, but my understanding, that was essentially their starting 11.
For the most part, yeah.
And they've got a lot of, I mean, I had forgotten that their goalkeeper was like one of the best, if not the best goalkeeper in La Liga this year.
Yeah, he's very good.
For Sevilla? Yeah. Isn't he with Sevilla? Yeah.
Yeah. The manager's in hot water, and he may not make it through to the World Cup. He may get fired before.
But isn't that his bit?
That is his bid to qualify for the World Cup, and they get fired.
And they get fired before.
He's done
the
this
World
with
Cup.
Three or four national teams, yeah.
So I guess my question is, did you watch the game
I did.
Live?
Uh-huh.
Or
both.
Okay.
Yeah.
So were you surprised by the result? U.S.
No.
won 3-0.
The scoreline, you mean. I think that's what you're asking.
Yeah.
Was I surprised by the scoreline?
Yeah.
Having watched the game, I'm surprised 3-0 was the end result because I think the game was a lot more even than the scoreline indicates.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you.
First 15-20 minutes, I'd argue that Morocco was the slightly better team, in fact. But then once the U.S. scored their first goal, they kind of then grooved into the game and they were decent after that.
It's funny. We're at that point of the calendar and getting ready for the World Cup that we go from just kind of playing these kind of whatever they be, friendlies or qualifiers or Gold Cup or these kind of other things that don't feel like they mean very much because they're not World Cup games, to getting to the point where now we really have to stop and start thinking about, all right, wait a second, who are Greg Berhalter's best 11?
Yeah, and he's trying to figure that out as well.
Because he's only got a few games left to do that.
Right, exactly. This is the deal. He has five or six of these tests, and he's got to experiment. It's not just finding your best 11. You got to determine your 26 too, but you got to figure out depth, and you have to figure out what happens if X player gets injured game one of the World Cup or gets injured right before the World Cup.
Well, and he's already having to deal with that because of Myles Robinson's Achilles injury for Atlanta. He's almost certainly not going to be able to play,
done.
And he was probably either the best or the second best center back he had.
Yes, but he's got five or six games to figure that out. If this happens right before the World Cup or during the World Cup, he won't have that luxury, so he's got to experiment now some, too, with formations and such.
All right, so in the game itself, the really interesting, again, because I love tactical stuff, I was fascinated to watch Berhalter make a unique tactical adjustment in the game, not an adjustment, but the plan where they kind of started in a 4-3-3, and as soon as they got the ball, they kind of shifted into a, I don't know, quasi three backs with two holding mids and five guys forward. And that worked really, really well in many ways, especially when they had the ball. It kind of fell apart a little bit when they lost the ball. But the fact that he's playing with these patterns of play and these tactical adjustments and strategies this late in the game, I find both fascinating and somewhat worrisome.
Yeah, so it's almost a 3-4-3 in some regards. So this is the first time I think we've seen Berhalter. It's a modern thing now where you have two different formations, one with the ball and one defending. The U.S. national team really hasn't done that, and it's hard for national teams to do it because you need a lot of training time. And guys getting used to things.
So what was our big criticism of Berhalter when he took this job is that he overcomplicated things and made it too difficult for players to do anything.
And then once we got in the groove where he wasn't doing that, he throws this
That's why I say I'm fascinated.
Yeah, but at the same time, look, he knows that he's got five or six tests to test his guys.
Mm-hmm.
He's got at least two, if not like 12 national team coaches that are, or staffs that are playing in the World Cup, looking at every one of his games as well, trying to analyze and predict how they're going to be, right? So he's got to throw a little bit of unpredictability there too. The thing about changing formations in game, the difficulty in that is, like you said, on the change of possession when you're back on defense, yeah, transition, yeah. If you don't have your ducks in a row, you're going to pay
and
for
Morocco
it.
Morocco probably should have scored multiple times. Between Matt Turner and some bad finishing.
Right.
Yeah. No, exactly. I agree. Yeah. How good is Brendan Aaronson?
Very impressive.
By the way, playing a position I think he looks really good at, in kind of a role at center in the middle of the field as an eight. Really impressed by that kid.
Yeah, but more so than playing out at the wing, right? I guess is where we've seen him. Yes.
Yeah.
And he's going to now go play in the Premier League. He's going to get even better. And I think he's making a good statement. And he's like, I don't know. I kind of see him being one of the starting 11, except, you know, we have some other guys that are injured that are going to be coming back to the midfield. Makes it a little bit more difficult for him. But he's looking really good.
Yes. And then the other moment in the game.
By the way, I'm sorry to interrupt. I thought I would have given him the highest rating of any player on the national team. I don't know if you would. Some gave it to Pulisic. I think the first goal was magical, what he did with the ball and the long ball, and then him laying it off to Aaronson. But other than that, he was okay. He was good, but not as best player of the game.
No, I thought Aaronson was the one that caught my eye the most. Right. You know what I'm saying? Now, the other thing, Haji Wright, by the way, the best moment of the game is the penalty kick, because Pulisic gave him the ball when he asked for it and got to score. And the reaction from his teammates, I don't know if you've been paying attention, but reading all the stories about kind of his journey to this point.
He's in Turkey now, right?
He's playing for Turkey. He was one of the top scorers in the Turkish, in their top division. Yeah. I can't pronounce the name of the team he's playing for, so I'm
it's
not going to try. And he's had a really, really good season. He's really played his way in here. But people, if you haven't read any of the stories, he and Pulisic were like chummy chums on the youth teams way back in the day. And they told the story during the game that when scouts from Borussia Dortmund came to scout and found Pulisic, it wasn't Pulisic they came to watch. It was Haji. Haji that they came to watch. Yeah. And his career has kind of gone up and down, where Pulisic's has skyrocketed. But they're still really good friends. And I just thought the reaction from his teammates when he scored the penalty kick was really interesting and telling. And I hope he looks like a legit true number nine in a different way than Jesus is. Yeah. And I think that's a valuable tool if, in fact, he can,
we'll see if it's long lasting
for them as well.
We saw 45 minutes.
Let me just say this real quick, because I know I don't want to go too long here, but there are and have been with Berhalter sequences and passages of play. And there's a moment, there's three or four of this in this particular game, where this team demonstrates an ability to progress a ball up the field with one-touch passing that is by far the best I've ever seen the U.S. men's national team do it, and some of the nicest you just will see, period, at any level. It's not super consistent, but they do it and they can demonstrate it. And to do it against a team like Morocco, I think is really, really promising.
Yeah.
Which then takes me back to this thing that I do every once in a while, and we don't have time to do it now. Maybe we'll talk more about it in another show. But if you ever really want to see about the progression of this nation as a soccer nation, go back and look at the rosters for each of the national teams dating back to 2002.
Mm-hmm.
You will be blown away at the number of players and where they were playing at that time when they were playing in the World Cup, up until this one here. And you begin to look at the roster of players that he has to select for this World Cup.
It's by far and away because of where they're playing, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
But my question is, when you were watching the 1998 U.S. men's national team, did you ever dream that we one day would have a World Cup roster filled with players playing at these clubs, playing at these levels in these leagues?
Dream? Yes. Did I think it was realistic?
Okay.
Probably not.
Yeah. Now it's all about.
But if you take a step back, man, this was part of the plan.
Yes. Now the trick, this is your and I's responsibility as people that, you know, do this and talk to people about soccer, is setting expectations for November and December.
Well, we have to figure out what expectations are first. We have to see how things develop through the summer.
That's our job. That's our role here, Andy. We need to help the P1 set their World Cup expectations properly.
We'll see what they do against Uruguay tomorrow. Starting lineup is out. We should talk about it before the show. Maybe in the dribble, we'll give out the starting lineup.
Yeah, we'll do that here a little bit later in the show. All right, when we come back, let's dive into all of those Premier League teams we haven't yet talked about. We'll do it next here on the Kick Around. We will talk about the important remaining World Cup qualifiers, specifically Wales and Ukraine, here in just a little bit, and find out, does Andy have any national team ties left for this World Cup? He has many to choose from, but I'm not sure he has any remaining at this point, so Andy, we'll check in with you here in a little bit. All right, the Premier League season is over. Man City are champions once again, as we all know. Whatever. And we talked a lot about the top of the table last week and the bottom of the table and those races and how they finished out. But what we didn't get to are the rest of you guys. And I wanted to make sure that we paid attention to that, because I do think there's fascinating and interesting things to talk about for most of those teams. Some of them, not so much. But I wanted to quickly run through some of these. And the first one, and we'll kind of go from the top to the, you know, to the next, we'll go from top to bottom. Okay. How about that? Right. And I wanted to start with Spurs, because I was thinking
they ended in fourth.
And I was thinking back, do you even remember now any of the first part of the season that started so poorly under Nuno? Like, that feels like that was a billion years ago to me.
Right. And remember all the controversy surrounding Kane.
Yes.
Right? And yes. The season was going to be a disaster. Kane's head wasn't right. And then Son kind of took things over a little bit until Kane could, like, quote, catch up.
Yes.
And kind of carry the team for a little bit. Remember that? When it was just Son?
By the way, Son not even being nominated for Player of the Year. That's
stupid.
That's a crime.
Yeah.
Absolute crime.
Yep.
But here's the big deal. So they get their coach in Conte. They bring him in. And I think, and I immediately go, all right, well, you better get your next guy already primed up, ready to go. But
And it played out like you predicted early, though, right? Remember, it was all kinds of crazy. I mean, things went from crazy to crazier.
Right. But here's the deal. They sell a bunch of players, including Ndombele, who never really turned it on, and they brought in two guys from Juventus, Bentancur and Kulusevski. Who really helped change this team and the skyrocketing end of the season that they largely had was really, really good. And then they probably enjoyed the fact that they ended up ahead of Arsenal again.
Yes, of course. And more importantly, they ended up in the Champions League.
And it ended up in Champions League.
And Conte, who months earlier was like, the things he was saying about his own team, I mean, I'm surprised he even like lasted a month after that, right?
But that's his bit.
That's his bit, I guess.
It's weird how
some
he gets
are pretty harsh.
It's funny how he gets away with that and Jose doesn't.
Maybe it's their approach or how Conte turns it around and loves his guys once they respond for him. But now, thinking ahead to next season with Conte now, because Conte's staying, it's official. It's going to be a pretty good team.
And there's money being spent. And it doesn't look like Harry
and
Kane's Kulusevski going anywhere.
Is 22?
He's young. Yeah.
All right.
Good stuff. All right. West Ham, are they not up at least as a candidate for best overall season based on expectations?
Yeah, although I had them seventh.
Oh,
I think
you?
I had them where they finished. Yeah, they
just
finished seventh.
When
right?
you consider, now I know maybe they didn't finish as high in the league as much as anybody would hope for, but when you tie how they performed in the Premier League along with how well they did in Europe,
yes,
I think that makes for a really, really good hammer season.
It was definitely a successful season, and they're back in Europe next year because they finished seventh. But I think the good run in Europe ultimately also hurt them a little bit in the domestic competition, because remember, early on, they got off to a flying start. They were top three, top four.
Yep.
And then they struggled, and then they didn't spend any money in January. And they don't have the depth of roster that the big, big clubs have, right? And I think ultimately squad rotation hurt them.
Well, and it was pretty clear at one point they saw a path to winning Europe and maybe put a little bit more focus on that. And that is probably what ended up hurting them in the battle for sixth place at the end of the season.
But had they won Europa League, they'd be in Champions League next year. So it was the good. It was a good gamble.
And what's interesting is that when you compare and contrast that now with Leicester, who finished just behind them, is I think that's the tale of two teams whose seasons kind of played out opposite of what I thought would happen, because Leicester's the club that really struggled with all the weight of the European responsibilities.
Also, same issue that West Ham had in terms of the lack of depth that the bigger clubs have. Leicester just wasn't able to overcome that. Their squad rotation wasn't good. They had more injury problems, though, than West Ham did.
Yes. And maybe Brendan Rodgers' situation at Leicester, I think, is, I'm assuming he's safe.
Yeah,
but he'll be one of those coaches when we start the next season, one of those managers that is on the betting odds towards the top of guys who are in the hottest situation.
Yeah, and we'll talk a lot more about next season, but next season is going to be tough. I think a little bit tougher than normal Premier League.
And it will, and we'll get to a very good reason why here in just a second. Next, I don't know if this is the biggest surprise of the season, but Graham Potter and Brighton ending in ninth. It's their best ever finish. Correct. Brighton's never finished this high in the top flight of England before. Mm-hmm. And I'm not convinced they probably wouldn't have done even a little bit better if they hadn't. You know, the season started with them scoring goals that they were finding impossible to score last year, which is what really hurt them last year. It's like, oh, they've solved their finishing problem. Mm-hmm. But then it kind of popped up. If they can get a consistent, dependable, regular goal scorer, I think Brighton is a real threat for next season to do, you know, push for a European spot.
Brighton didn't score a home goal from late January to mid-April. That's insane.
It is.
Shows how well they did on the road, but you got to score at home.
Right. But it also shows how they, because you probably would have said something similar about their season last year. Mm-hmm. You could tell all sorts of statistical problems with scoring they had last year, and they really looked like they had solved it.
And then it
Mape and whatever that guy's name, I always forget his name. Tressman? Anyway. Those guys, you know, had appeared to solve their scoring problem, and then it just kind of popped back up again, as you said. Mm. Behind them is Wolves.
Yeah.
And this is probably, you know, they ended up 10th, but I'm not convinced that this, if you're a Wolves fan, this has to be a disappointing season.
It does, especially because you were doing better than just finishing 10th.
Well, you also got Jimenez back.
Right.
And I think you thought, well, maybe we'll solve some of the problems that plagued us last year because we lost him.
They struggled a lot at the end, though.
They really did.
Yeah. Especially once he was back in form and shape. Their goalkeeping saved them a little bit, too.
I do begin to wonder that with some of the sales of players that they've made over the last couple of years and not necessarily replacing them with anything grand. I do wonder if we've seen Wolves do that thing you see in the Premier League every once in a while, which is a kind of lower end to mid table team really peak and kind of just top out, and now they're coming back down the hill a little bit.
And then once you hit that hill, it can go down quickly.
Yes. And the next team is really the one that I think you are referring to when you talk about how next season's going to get so tight, which is Newcastle.
Yeah.
Do you realize...
Well, yeah, that and other reasons.
Do you realize that if you consider just the second half of the season, no team collected... only Liverpool collected more points in 2022 than Newcastle.
Well, they spent like...
And in January 13th, they were in 19th place. Yeah.
I'd pick them to get relegated. They were bad. And then they spent like $85 million in January.
And they finished closer to a European spot than they did to relegation.
That's crazy. So they had a really good run. They spent a lot of money. They kind of gave us a preview what this team's going to be all about. Nation state spending a lot of money on players and them shooting up.
And they spent a lot of money. They did. But I think the argument could be made there the best and smartest purchase was getting Eddie Howe to come work.
Yeah,
for
there's people arguing, well, you know, whatever coach would have been able to do something with all that money. And then others are saying, no, you got to just not automatic like that. And Howe's a good coach. We'll see. Next season, it's his. We'll see.
All the money they've got, that is a sleeping giant of a club.
Sure, yeah, because I mean, it's got the
history,
the
branding.
Yes.
I mean, you don't have to be a hardcore soccer fan to immediately identify with the black and white stripes. I mean, it just is what it is.
Yep.
And, you know, set aside all the nation state stuff. If they can spend smartly, even slowly, and do it right, man, that becomes a really serious problem for everybody else.
Yes.
I mean, they could quickly jump in front of Spurs and United and Arsenal.
Yeah, it's the Arsenals that are a little bit worried about this. I would like West Ham, right? I mean, they're right there. They're in a sweet spot, and now they got to deal with Newcastle coming up.
That is going to be probably number one on things to watch list for the next season, for sure. All right, we've got a few more teams to talk about, including Brentford, the Bees, in their season. And we'll talk about all that next year on The Kick Around. Welcome back to The Kick Around, Saturdays 2 to 4 here on The Ticket. I'm Peter. That bar is Andy Swift. Look him up on the internet. He's a big deal. We were talking Premier League finishes to the season and, you know, getting all kind of interested in what is going to happen with Newcastle next year. But the other really fascinating story, because Newcastle's fascinating for all the news that happened with them off the field, tied to the sale to the Saudi, you know, state and all that stuff, and the fact that they spent money and hired a good coach and really rocketed up the deal. And when it comes to stories of the season, I think at least for me, the most surprising is the next one, which is Crystal Palace. Yeah. Because I had predicted they'd get relegated.
Right,
did you get, were they on your relegation list?
No, they weren't, because I had a couple of years before.
And let me just say this. I don't feel bad that I predict, or stupid, because I think a lot of people predicted they could be a relegation candidate based on the fact that Patrick Vieira had not really shown any really great outstanding managerial traits.
Oh, you managed an MLS.
Yeah. And we didn't really enjoy him very much up in New York, and he had done a couple other weird things. Their contract situation with all these players was weird. They had a really, really old roster. It just felt like if there's a team that's going to melt and fall down to ESPN Plus, it was that one. But man, they completely blew me away at how he blew me away with how well he managed Palace this year.
Yeah, and not just managed them well, I think, in terms of results, but they were just a fun team to watch. It was an exciting brand of football, as they call it, right?
Wilfred Zaha, I think, is the one player nobody else in any league wants to play with. He looks like the least fun guy in the world to play with, but somehow Vieira managed to manage him.
Yeah, because he knew that that was key. That's always been key. That's the thing with Crystal Palace. We've been saying this for 5 years. That guy is key. And when he goes south, the team goes south.
Let me also throw, another player that I was really impressed with, and I'm interested to see what happens with him next year, Conor Gallagher. He was so good for Palace, consistent. What a great little player. I don't know what's, you know, he's on loan from Chelsea. I don't know if Chelsea will take him back, or, you know, if he fits in with Tuchel or not.
He's 22, right?
He's very young. But also consider this. Over the course of the season, Palace, a team I predicted to get relegated, beat Manchester United, Arsenal, Tottenham, and City, and ended up in the FA Cup semifinal.
Yeah. Good season.
That's about as far away from being a relegation team as it gets. So good for Palace.
Another reason why next year's Premier League is going to be tough.
Next on the list is the Bees.
Yeah. This has got to be a good story and a surprise to a certain extent, right?
I'm sure Brentford was also on a lot of people's.
What was final placement? 13th? 14th?
14th. And we talked a lot about this, but adding Christian Eriksen and the quality of a player of his level, thankfully he was able to come back from his near-death experience, literally, and play as well as he did, because there was a frightening time in November, December where you thought, uh-oh, they're starting to dip their toes back
into the
relegation.
Good start, and then teams have figured him out. That was November, December until he came.
And then everything changed with him.
Right.
And it's not that they became world beaters, but they found a consistent way of winning just enough points to keep themselves safe. But here's what I remember about Brentford more than anything else, is that very first game of the season at their little mm-hmm. brand newish stadium mm-hmm. that holds like 18,000 people against Arsenal and beating Arsenal yeah. on the first week of the season.
Walking out to Hey Jude.
That was great. Yeah. Those were great scenes.
And I will say this one thing about Brentford too. Don't shoot me for saying it. Pew. You old school soccer Pew. Farts. Analytics. They're an analytics team. And they yes. scored after Liverpool and City, who was far and away. They were the top scorers in set pieces. Brentford was next.
Did I read an article that they are restarting their academy? You know, Brentford is famous mm-hmm. for shutting down their academy several years ago in a big mm-hmm. money move. I'm pretty sure I okay. saw a headline that they're restarting their academy now that they've got all yeah. this Premier League money
nice.
That they bathe in like all the others mm. do. All right, next on the list is Sean Bass's Aston Villa.
Yeah. You know, I ultimately disappointing season, obviously, to finish where they did. And I think your question to me is going to be, well, what happened after Stevie Gerrard came on? And did he make them better or not? And he did initially. It looked like, you know, but then...
But I think the story of Villa's season is... Both parts of it, the Dean Smith part mm-hmm. after selling Jack Grealish and getting all that Grealish money and how they spent it because they brought in some really nice players.
Yeah.
But again, trying to get those players, Buendia and Ings, all kind of integrated into the system and making it work.
Yeah, Buendia was... Yeah.
Didn't, obviously. Yeah, no. And so Dean Smith gets blown out. Mm-hmm. Stevie Gerrard comes in and they sign Philip Coutinho.
Yeah.
And man, there was...
Big impact early.
Yeah, but then Coutinho does Philip Coutinho things and right. kind of goes up and yeah, down. Right. We've seen him do that for multiple teams.
Yeah. But then in the last game of the season, he scored a goal and won the season for Liverpool. Wait.
No,
almost.
He didn't.
Won the season for Liverpool.
That'll be another one to keep an eye on. And maybe the most forgettable... This is the South... Let me just say this. Southampton. That is the one season that I had the hardest time trying to come up with some memorable moment for.
Just meh.
Because they were just so not a big deal. Didn't they also have another, maybe the only thing is, didn't they lose another game this season, like 7-0?
Like another spanking
or
early
a 9
on.
Nothing or yeah. whatever the record is.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that maybe again happened this year, which you'd want to forget. They sold Ings and now they didn't replace it. I mean, how many players from Southampton can you name other than James Ward-Prowse?
Right. I can name a whole bunch that played for Southampton that are now doing great things for other teams.
Sadio
like
Mane.
Liverpool. Yeah, with yeah. Mane and.
Well, it is the and, Liverpool
Mane and,
grocery store for players, by yeah. the way.
Van Dijk.
Oh, yeah. I was like, what are you talking
about? Yeah, kind of like, I can't remember one of the best players on Liverpool. Yeah. So yeah, it was just, I guess, a typical Southampton season then. I mean, this is kind of like at the end of every season, this, you know, memorable in very unmemorable ways.
Yeah, the way, and I think I'm correct in saying that they didn't win a game in like their last 15 or 10 plus games or something. Wow.
No bueno.
And that's a team that I think people like because they grow their own and they've had a successful, you know, I don't know. I'm assuming if you're a Saints fan, you found this particular season to be extremely frustrating. And Hasenhüttl is another coach that will start next season, I'm assuming, on the super hot seat.
Yeah, but he's withstood pressure before. I'm looking... Reason I'm a little bit in and out is I'm looking to see if I can find that score, but I wasn't able to.
And then, of course, we get to ye old Everton. Mm. They squeaked it out. Hey, they got it done, Andy.
Yeah. They were 16th when Lampard took over.
They were 4 points away from relegation and 16th.
And they finished 16th, 4 points from
relegation. Yes, they did.
So he... That's a neat story. He prevented them from going down, Sammy, right?
That's all I asked him to do. That's my only goal any season. Don't get relegated.
The question for Everton, look, they survived. It was great scenes at Goodison. By the way, what's up with the pitch invasions? They're happening everywhere now. I was like giving Tyler a hard time about those happening in Germany.
Well,
now we've seen some in England and
yes, and there's been some really bad scenes where players have been
yes
injured or attacked, coaches, whatever. This is going to be one of those deals where between now and the start of next season, the authorities are going to crack yes down hard on that.
Because it's been happening in lots of places now.
Yeah.
But
like running on the field and having a good time is one thing. But when you start confronting players, yep, that's when everybody goes, okay, we're just going to start making changes.
Yep. So Everton, mission accomplished. They survive. It was a terrible season. Most important part is they didn't get relegated. But now as they look ahead to 2022 with this much improved Premier League that we're going to have next season, who's to argue they're not going to be in the relegation battle again? This is Everton. I know I'm saying this about Everton, but do you have extremely high hopes of them like turning this around on a dime and instantly going back to the middle or the top?
No. Well, it was the Dallas Cup homestay referee that I'm friends with that is is Ian Hewson. He is an Everton fan, and so I was trading messages with him because I always try to judge my Everton mm-hmm situation through him because he's grown up as an Everton fan. And I was trading messages with him, and he's like, you know, when I'm watching these celebrations at Goodison Park and everybody's hugging Frank Lampard, mm-hmm, which feels really weird because I feel like it was just hours ago that people were ready to, mm-hmm, you know, stab him in the back, and now everybody's hugging him. It's like, I'm really uncomfortable with this level of hero worship that Frank's getting at Everton. Is that really deserved? And he said, here's the thing, more than anything else that everybody should realize, is that Frank did help reconnect the fans back to the club and solve some of the locker room issues and the relationship issues between the club and the fan base that had grown so poor during
but had it grown poor because they were about to get relegated and the fans were like, I mean, it was results based,
well,
right?
Well, it was all results based, but he also kind of got people to believe in them again and get them to understand that our ability to stay in this league is going to be tied to your support,
okay,
when we're playing home games or on the road. And I think that was the one thing that we saw so consistently out of that run was even when they were falling behind or giving up stupid goals, the Goodison Park fan base was unbelievably supportive.
Okay.
And it appears fine that Everton's fan feel that is a Frank Lampard byproduct.
Great, awesome for the fans and the relationship. Is that going to solve their problems on the field?
Well, so that gets to point two, which is Frank's dealing with the last X amount of managers, players, and roster, and we need to give him an opportunity to pick his guys.
Sure, of course. Look, they spent so much money and have spent so much money in recent times and have done it really poorly. Is he going to make them more intelligent upstairs?
I don't know. Sam, what is the situation? Wasn't there a Russian owner or investor that now is out, that now that money's gone too?
Yes. So Alisher Usmanov was a big investor in the club. He had sponsorship at Finch Farm. He was putting a lot of money into the new stadium as well. And once the war in Ukraine broke out,
is he an oligarch?
Yeah, he is very close to, like, he is right, like.
Not, so you had an oligarch running things
for you? Sponsoring things, not running
okay
things.
Wasn't right running things.
Yeah. Like, we have an Iranian
giving
running
you the money.
Things.
Okay.
That's completely different.
All right, okay.
But Usmanov was very close to, not quite Roman Abramovich close, but like that next circle.
But he was providing funds.
He was putting quite a bit, like 9 figures worth of money.
And your sporting director was making the decisions.
Yeah, Marcel Brands, before he got fired, making those decisions.
And then the new guy.
And now you've got Kevin Thulwell from Red Bulls who's in. And that's one of the big things, you know, talking about Frank. He and Thulwell are very aligned, like,
okay,
tactically. They have the same idea of what they want. So they may still fail.
Yeah.
But at least there's a lot more unity in the front office.
So there has been change up top, too.
Yeah,
okay.
In January, they conducted a review of the organization top down, and they're like, this is what needs to change.
No, this is good because they needed that. I mean, it wasn't working.
Is the stadium deal dead?
Stadium deal sponsorship is dead right now. They're right now, it's just going to be Bramley Moore. The stadium is still going up.
Okay.
They got about $75 million from Liverpool, the area, to put that up. They've privately
the
funded. Not the club. That would be nice, Andy, if you could have given us some money.
Well, we need Everton to stay up. Liverpool does.
I think so. It's a better world.
Yeah, plus it's two games on the schedule that we don't want to miss out on.
No, just kidding.
In all seriousness, it is important for the drama in Liverpool. But it's good to see that they made changes up top.
All right, so that gets us through the list of everybody that was in the league this season, and because we talked about all the other teams at the top and the bottom last week, what we haven't talked about yet is now who's returning or who's coming to the league. And it is returning because the three teams that are coming up have all been in the Premier League before, some more recently than others. First off, Fulham, who had an amazing season in the Championship.
Yeah, and Fulham's problem has been that they've been promoted and then relegated immediately after, like the last few times. But the difference now is, right, they finished in first by a lot.
Okay, but I feel
the other times they kind of, they had to win playoffs, right?
Yeah, but didn't Norwich, maybe not to the degree that Fulham.
But Norwich is the only one that has been the exception in that regard. All other teams that have won the Championship have tended to stay, except for Norwich.
Okay.
Norwich has been, and they've been the ultimate yo-yo club. Norwich has.
Fulham, and they're, by the way, if you've not watched any of the videos of the almost now completed upgrades to Craven Cottage, it is amazing to see what they've done. So, as you don't know, Fulham Stadium sits literally on the Thames River, and the one side is up against the river, and they tore all that down, and they've put a multi-story kind of very modern-looking thing right there. It looks so cool. And it's not cheap to go to those games. I think season tickets are like £1,000, and people are freaking out about that. But it looks really cool. And it's a weird juxtaposition because the rest of the stadium is very old.
Yep.
I mean, it literally has this old English cottage in
it
the corner.
Is. Yes.
And they've got this new modern thing, but they've finished it in time for them to return to the Premier League. If you ever go to London, you should go to a game there. It's awesome.
So you're thinking Fulham will drop quickly?
I don't know.
Mitrovic is key, right? If he keeps banging goals, he didn't do it the last time.
Right. I'm not going to, until I see what kind of business they do in the transfer window, I don't think there's any way to tell. The next is Bournemouth. Bournemouth is back up. The Cherries in their tiny little stadium.
Yeah. Tougher road to hoe for them.
Yep.
Staying up.
And then we got Nottingham Forest. They won in the playoff final against Huddersfield Town.
Did you see that Horvath got some minutes at the very end?
I did.
You like cringing? Oh my God, what if
please don't give this up. I'm excited about this because, as you said, talked about last week, this is a club that was in the Premier League back when the Premier League became something you could watch in the United States back in the day, way back when. And that is a historic club. Yeah. And it's kind of cool to see them
kind of like a Newcastle. You know, make their way
back up.
You know, the interesting thing about Forrest is their sporting director is from the U.S., a young kid, American kid. Mm-hmm. Analytics, again. He's incorporating analytics into the purchase of players and such. I know I know a lot of people are like rolling their eyes, but you know, hey, it worked for them.
I had to do a little bit of research because I had a weird quandary when I was watching the celebrations after they won the playoff final against Huddersfield, and they were all doing the getting up into the stands and raising the trophy and celebrating, or not in the stands. I guess they had a deck or whatever out there. I can't remember how they do it at Wembley.
The most expensive game
in the world. And I thought, man, they're celebrating coming in third place, and hold on.
Okay.
Because that's what they did. They're celebrating coming in third place. Now, I know it's promotion, and I thought, well, this is weird, because I know that Fulham got a trophy for winning the championship, and they had a big celebration. And now Nottingham Forest is celebrating essentially coming in third place. What about Bournemouth? What does Bournemouth get other than promotion and all the money that comes with it? It turns out Bournemouth also gets a trophy.
Oh, they do?
Yes.
So they get to present it to the in front of the fans?
There are three trophies, one for first, second, and the winner of the playoff final.
Okay.
And they're all essentially 5 centimeters smaller than the one above it.
Okay, all right.
Yes. I thank you to our good friend Lars Siverston, who has a lot of time on his hands while he
researches this.
Remains in the hospital to this day.
Come on, Lars. Godspeed. Godspeed to you.
Lars, by the way, just update on Lars. Mm-hmm. He's had surgery. The word puzzle was used in putting his ankle and leg back together.
Wow.
Yeah. So he is on, hopefully on his way to good health. Best wishes and love to Lars, and hopefully he'll be able to come back on the show again sometime soon.
Hey, so they celebrate third place, but again, it's like a $200 million revenue.
It just made me laugh. You think about this, and I thought about, hey, there's a team that actually finished higher than you, and they're not getting to do this. It's pretty funny to me. Yeah. It is weird and different. All right, so there you go. We'll talk more about the upcoming Premier League season, it feels like, in a few hours, because it happens fast around here. But when we come back, there is a game in particular that is about to happen tomorrow. It is going to be big, and it affects you, fans of the United States. We'll talk Wales and Ukraine next here on The Kick Around. Andy has elected to abdicate his fandom as a Liverpool supporter and jump on that Real Madrid bandwagon.
Not a bandwagon, just looking back at history.
Andy wants to do his TED talk on the magic of the Real Madrid season here in a little
Liverpool
bit.
Was playing like doo-doo.
Do you regret asking to do this segment now that I'm...
No. Props to Madrid.
Yes, welcome back to the Kick Around. All right. Oh, say Liverpool's it. Better than Man U. Totally.
All right. Thank
I
you.
I deserve that,
Peter.
So here we are. As we said at the beginning of the show, it would be this time normally every 4 years that Annie and I would be all giddy, all excited about a World Cup, but we're not getting to do that yet because it doesn't happen until the start of the week of Thanksgiving. Yes, just remember, the week of Thanksgiving is when the U.S. will play its first game on game day, match day one. We don't know who they're going to play yet. And that's
what? How do we not know who they're going to play? What's going on here?
There's some qualifications still to happen, Andrew. And we'll talk. Yeah, so that is going to be determined tomorrow. And that is Ukraine is playing Wales. And the winner of that game will fall into Group B with the United States, Iran, and England.
Yes. So Ukraine had to beat Scotland. They had.
Was it Wednesday?
Wednesday.
Yeah, it was Wednesday.
Wednesday.
At Hampden Park, by the way.
Right. Did you get to watch any of that game?
I've seen little bits and pieces of it.
So Ukraine outplayed, by far outplayed Scotland.
Here's what I saw. And this is what happened when I saw the end of the game, is I got very nervous because it dawned on me, something I hadn't really thought about, that Ukraine may end up in the group with the United States because it's, you know, you talk about how heart and emotion can affect a team's performance.
Yeah.
And if there was ever a textbook example of that, it was how Ukraine played in Scotland against Scotland and beat them as pretty thoroughly as they did.
They did. And it was all about how they started the game. And you could see that then fitness and the lack of not being able to have camp and all that in their proper environment started to catch up to them.
Well, did you know that more than half of the starters for Ukraine have not played any official soccer matches since December of last year? Because six of those guys all play in the Ukrainian Premier League.
And they shut down.
And they shut down back in December. Those guys have not played soccer for however many months now. So and they put out that performance.
Yeah. So, but come the 70th minute, you could then tell, okay, and this is when Scotland started to press a little bit more, and they score their goal before they got countered on. So anyway, Ukraine has advanced, and they will play Wales. So my question to you, and you kind of brought it up here, is from a U.S. supporter perspective, who do you root for here? Because, you know, even though Ukraine is slightly favored now over Wales, that surprised me a little bit because Wales is at home, and Wales has a decent team.
If Ukraine wins this and makes it to the World Cup, it'll be such a fantastic story because, you know, having to deal with what they've been dealing with domestically with the war and all of this stuff, players wanting to not play and go and join their army and I'm sure every single one of those guys has friends or family that have been killed in that conflict.
Yep. Everybody's affected on that team.
Everybody's affected, and the ability to turn that into the performance they turned into and whether or not they can do that against Wales. By the way, Wales, I think, to be fair, is a significantly better team than Scotland.
Yes.
I think Wales has been playing quite well.
Yeah. They're aging a little bit, but they have good players.
Yes. I mean, Gareth Bale, probably still has it in him to pull off one a few more magic moments. The Welsh fans, like the Scottish fans, are boisterous and really behind them. They're really into this. They're not playing in the giant stadium in Swansea. They're playing in the smaller national stadium in Cardiff.
To make it more intimidating.
Very, very, you know, big atmosphere. So that's going to be interesting.
Are you rooting for Wales?
Well, yes, I'm going to root for Wales because I like the idea of Wales. I think Wales being in the group with England is a bigger factor for the United States and the English having to play Wales because of that kind of regional conflict.
Kind of like if it was Scotland, same idea.
Or if the United States ended up, not that they would, but if they ended up with Mexico, for example, in a group, that would be the same kind of thing.
Yeah, so you are going to root against Ukraine.
Well, I have no heart.
I was rooting for Scotland, obviously, because of heritage, but it's hard to root against Ukraine.
It is.
Right? It's just, you feel like, man, what a story.
It will be interesting to watch all of that play down. Now, the reason why it's such a big game, ESPN has decided to move the game from ESPN 2 to Big Boy ESPN. I think it's at 11 tomorrow, or maybe maybe pregame starts at 11. I don't remember. Sam or somebody can confirm that for me, please. And, you know, it's just going to be the atmosphere of watching that. Because no matter who wins, by the way, if Wales wins the game, it's the first time they will have been in the World Cup since 1958. Just the only time Wales has been in the World Cup is 1958. The last game they played in the World Cup was against Brazil. And who scored against them?
Pele.
A very, very young Pele.
Yeah. This is historic for Wales, and it's so historic for Ukraine as well. It's
right, that's what I'm saying. No matter who wins,
I know.
I mean, if Wales wins, the scenes in that stadium are going to be bonkers because the Welsh people are so hungry to return to the World Cup for all the obvious reasons.
Right. And they've kind of been underdogs to England, even Scotland, Ireland, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, there's been a very long stretch of time, and maybe that's even still true outside of this country, that Wales is more known as a rugby nation than a football nation.
Right, yeah.
So that, I think, is, I mean, if you're a neutral, watch the game. You're going to win either way. You're either going to get to watch Wales celebrate returning to the World Cup for the first time, literally and forever. I'm sorry, what, Sam?
So the TV for tomorrow's game is going to be ESPN 11 a.m. our time.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to know. And or you're going to get to watch Ukraine continue with this crazy run to the World Cup.
Right.
Even before the conflict started, Ukraine was not by any stretch of the imagination picked to make it to the World Cup.
Right.
So to now make it.
Yeah, despite all the issues.
Despite all this stuff, it's going to be pretty amazing.
Now, Wales, semifinals in 2016, Euros, round of 16 in the 2020. So they have a little bit of recent history where they've done well in European competition. They just want to translate that to World Cup.
Against Scotland, for the parts that I saw and the stuff that I read, I think the general consensus was people were really impressed with how organized they were and how they used their emotion to their advantage and not to their disadvantage.
Yeah.
And
they know what they're playing for, I guess. Right.
And not losing their head or not, you know, just, you know, sometimes you get so worked up, it works against you. And that wasn't the case. Now, whether or not that works in the game tomorrow is to be seen.
Yeah. More importantly, you got to do it for 90. And that's where they, like, you could see it. It was, and they always talk about this, a team that gets a red card early on, you see it about the 65th or 70th minute where they start to pay for that. And you saw it. It was like a light switch turn. Around the 70th minute, Scotland started to really dominate in possession. And so we'll see if Wales can take advantage of
that. So right around 11 o'clock tomorrow on ESPN, Wales and Ukraine. Now, there are actually three other games that are still to be played to determine two final slots in the World Cup. First off is Tuesday. What's today? Today, yeah. So Tuesday, the United Arab Emirates is playing Australia for that particular federation's final Asian space. The winner of that game will face off against Peru on the 13th in Qatar. In fact, all three of these games are being played in Qatar.
Yeah. Neutral ground.
Yes. I'm assuming you know Peru better than I do, but Peru's a substantially better team than either the UAE or Australia, right?
They are, but the game being played in Qatar, and if it's UAE, that's very close to home.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of travel for Peru. Peru's not bad, but they were fifth out of South America. You know, they weren't one of the top four. So, you know, Australia's always good. It'll be a good close game, I think. It's not going to be a blowout by any means.
All right. So that happens on the third. Well, the first game is Tuesday, the UAE versus Australia. And the winner of that will play Peru on the 13th. On the 14th is Costa Rica and New Zealand.
Right. And that's another one where Costa Rica is the, quote, favored, right? But New Zealand, the problem for New Zealand is they're out of Oceania. Mm-hmm.
Oceania.
Thank mm-hmm. you. And they have zero competition. I mean, they are really no other really strong soccer nations in their confederation that test them. And so they qualify.
Were you here the day we talked about how the Oceania qualifying process finally got around to happening because of COVID? Were you in the show? Were you on the show that day, or was it somebody else?
Yeah, no, I don't remember.
With the like how all these teams traveled.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And then they couldn't play because they got COVID.
Yeah, and they're all like little island nations.
Yeah, Solomon Islands, yeah, exactly. And Tonga.
Fiji and all that, yeah. So I think Costa Rica should be able to beat New Zealand, but New Zealand has played in World Cups, and they're seasoned in some regards. So,
with the World Cup coming up, I was tweeting about this earlier, and I keep thinking about this, which is... I am interested. There's the one thing I'm more interested than anything else about the tournament that maybe is not on the field related is how the scheduling of this tournament in November and December ends up affecting its large scale interest here in the United States. Because the tournament being scheduled in November and December is the meat of the American sports calendar. Mm-hmm. You're right in the hardest, most important part of the NFL season. College football, the start of NHL, NBA, mm-hmm. all of that stuff going on. And I'm not sure we're all prepared for how little mainstream American media doesn't have the bandwidth to cover the World Cup in the same way that they do when the tournament is played in its right. normal June, July.
Yeah, when things
place,
are slow.
When there's nothing else going on.
Yeah, I think we'll see a good amount of coverage for the U.S. national team, particularly if they do well, and the England game is going to get hype. But I think where we're going to lose some coverage is everything else, right?
Yeah.
How much they cover the rest of the World Cup.
Yes. And because the games are kind of in wonky times, again, if you haven't heard, the games will be played Dallas time at 4 a.m., 7 a.m., 11 a.m., and 1 p.m., every day through the group stage the first 2 weeks, including Thanksgiving Day. I don't know, man. I just don't know if we're all prepared for that. Now, on the flip side, if the World Cup is able to be deemed successful media-wise, like the rating, because the coverage will dictate interest, will dictate ratings, mm-hmm. right? And if somehow the ratings on the tournament end up being good, that's when I think you have to watch out, because that's when enterprise business and media in general will completely refocus itself towards the sport
yeah.
leading up to 2026 because the tournament's here in the United yeah. States.
I think we'll get a little bit of that anyway, even if the ratings aren't great.
No. Just because the tournament's coming here, yeah I agree. Yeah. What I'm saying is if they can prove that the sport can get eyeballs, even in the middle of the NFL and college yeah. football seasons, that's when people are going to like, okay, yeah. now we It'll really need level. To.
Remember, the games will be in the morning.
That's what I just said.
Right. When it comes to ratings, though, so that'll help ratings. And you're saying coverage helps ratings, but the fact that they're in the morning. So leading up to the tournament, if there's enough coverage, remember, the U.S. plays their first game early in the World Cup.
Day one.
Against Ukraine or Wales.
Right.
That's a win. And then it sets up a lead up to England. And a
the
lot
second
of people.
Game, yeah. And the second game is Black Friday.
Against England. So that first game is in the morning. So if there's coverage and support for that one game that will be played in the morning that people can watch without having to miss football, and the ratings are strong and the U.S. gets a good result, that can parlay into what you're talking
about.
Well,
the game, the U.S. games are all at 1 p.m.
Yeah.
All three group stage U.S. games are at one.
Oh, I thought there was one that was in the morning.
It was originally, but when they reallocated the time slots, the U.S. got all the 1 p.m. slots. Yeah.
So then it will go against football. Well, no, because it's
a Monday.
Weekday. Yeah,
it's a Monday.
So it'll be fine.
Yeah, I think no matter what happens, even if it's a June, July, the games being kind of 4 a.m., 7 a.m. isn't going to help the rating situation. No. I think that's part of the problem. And I think everybody will calibrate their expectations accordingly. I'm just saying, I don't be surprised if all of us hardcore soccer fans get into the meat of the tournament and we're like, you know, nobody really seems to be into this. And I think part of it will be because a lot of their mainstream media coverage just won't be talking about it.
Yeah, if the U.S. national team does well, it'll be different. It's all about how well the U.S. national team, because the American consumer, the American sports fan likes to win. And if the team is winning, they're going to get into this.
So I'll go back to what I said in segment number one. You and I have a responsibility, and that's helping set expectations, Andy. I know you look very uncomfortable with that responsibility. But
no,
with power comes great responsibility.
World Cup. Come on.
Setting expectations. All right. When we come back, Andy pushed me up against the wall and said, I want to talk about Real Madrid and how they beat Liverpool in the Champions League final last Sunday. And
Such
we'll let him
liar.
Do that next here on the Kick Around. It is our favorite song, Andy. By the way, welcome back to the Kick Around. Saturdays 2 to 4 here on the Ticket.
Did I tell you how the guy that composed this song is a multi-jillionaire?
Yes, we talked about that last
week. He's making 10 cents right now in his bank account.
Cumulus is paying money out of its pocket.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, at least they're paying somebody.
A necessary shot, Sam.
All right.
So, a little less than a week ago, we all sat down in front of our giant flat-screen TVs.
Damn.
Andy, you've got an 85-inch television? Is that what I understand?
No, mine's tiny. It's my little iPad.
And we turned on the Channel 11 and watched the Champions League final. Real Madrid and Liverpool.
Yeah. And we were fortunate that we were able to do the show 12 to 2 that week and we could watch the game. The game kicked off. By the way, we should address this. Game kicked off late.
But I actually got home in time to see kickoff. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, because kickoff was delayed because of all
45 minutes
the
or something
outside
right.
the stadium. Yeah, right. And then they were blaming Liverpool fans, and now we know that that wasn't the case. It's the ineptitude of the French police. But I digress. Because Real Madrid sent him a letter as well. Real Madrid also had fans affected. It wasn't just Liverpool. And one thing we talked about before the game was that Real Madrid had the advantage that they won La Liga weeks before this game, right? And Liverpool had to be fighting for...
You hear this, Sam?
No. Look, it played out exactly. And Liverpool was in the hunt for the title all the way to the end. And they couldn't... They had to keep rotating players. And Real Madrid had to rest players, or was able to rest players. Mm-hmm. And their midfield is like a jillion years old. Like you told me the combined
98,
age, right?
96 or 98.
Right.
Yeah,
so
right.
One question would have been like after this long season, then you got to play this final, but they were able to rest. And that ultimately gave Real Madrid an advantage. And it was some heroic goalkeeping because
Courtois was bonkers.
Right.
For sure.
And heading into the game, you asked for my prediction. And I said, look, Real Madrid, this is that effing team. This is a team of destiny. And it just seems weird given Real Madrid that label, right?
Yeah, considering they've won the Champions League
more than any other team
billion times.
Right, exactly. Right. But in fact, they were. And as a Liverpool fan, it just felt inevitable that this was going to happen, that Real Madrid was going to do something out of the ordinary to win that game. And they did. In this case, it was the goalkeeper that had a career game.
Okay, stop. I want to take 1 minute here to reflect on something, in that this was a stat that I heard repeated multiple times in the aftermath of the loss, which was Liverpool had played in
63.
How many finals did you guys play in this year and you had scored zero goals?
Well, the two cups in England.
Right. And this one.
So
well, no. I mean, it's just
thanks.
It's a finishing thing, right? So, Courtois was out of his mind, but it is a reality that Liverpool played in three finals and didn't score a goal, and two of which they had to go to penalty kicks. Mm-hmm. One they won, you know, whatever. And so
I won both.
They won those. They didn't win this one because it didn't get that far. But I think that's part of the deal, which is finishing.
Fair.
Okay.
Fair.
That's all I'm saying. And fair. Now, in
but
this
he did have three world-class saves.
In this particular game, it was also aided by the fact that Courtois played one of the best goalkeeping performances I've ever seen.
He did, and their midfield, look, for all their age, from the 70th to the 90th minute, was very good.
It was. And it's very unfortunate for poor Trent Alexander-Arnold to have the quote of "I see things other players don't," and then to miss out on Vinicius Jr. Sneaking in from behind.
Real Madrid didn't
see that when we all saw it coming.
Two shots on goal. They scored on one of them. That was Real Madrid.
Yeah.
Right. And that was Vinicius' goal. And that's that was the other storyline heading into the game. You know, that was going to be an issue. That particular battle, and Real Madrid won that battle. But start thinking about this Real Madrid run, and I think this gets, it doesn't get, it. I don't think it's, it, we've made a big deal enough about this, and I think part of it is because Real Madrid ended up winning the Champions League, and it's Real Madrid, and they've done it so many times, and also this particular run, because it takes place over several months. Like, if this kind of run, with them having done what they did, if it gets done like in a World Cup setting, over a month, it's like, oh my God, right? Or if it's like a NCAA basketball tournament, right, where it's played over the course of 6 weeks, mm-hmm. There's a lot more attention paid to specifically the things they had to do to get there. So let's remember what Real Madrid had to do to get there. Once they advanced past the group stage. And they lost.
Are we going to quickly talk about how they lost to Sheriff?
Right. But see, this is another great point. Heading into this Champions League, Real Madrid was not one of the favorites. They were like, their midfield's too old.
Oh.
Their number nine is too old.
Yes, this was a transitional.
Courtois never plays and comes up big.
This was going to be a transitional season.
Right.
Because they were dealing with all the money problems and the Super League drama and all that.
Right. Second date in the Champions League, they lose at home against a team from Moldova. Right? So this is Real Madrid now heading into the knockout stages. And the round of 16, they have to play against the team built to win the Champions League, the most expensive team in the world, one that has Messi, Neymar, and Mbappe playing as forwards. Right? The team built to win the Champions League. And they go down 2-0 against them. In the second tie, it's like the 70th minute, they're down 2-0. And what they need is a sublime, Superman-like hat trick from Benzema. 17-minute hat trick, and that's how they were able to get by. I mean, you saw those goals, right? You watched the game live. It wasn't just a hat trick. There were some outwardly goals scored by Benzema. So that's what they needed to get past PSG. Okay, fine. That was luck, fate, whatever, a one-time Benzema. Superman-like effort. Now you have Chelsea in the quarterfinals, the defending champs.
Yes.
Who you go at their home field and you spank them 3-1, and then you come home in the second tie at home, and then you lay an egg, and they score three goals, right? I think it was they were up 4-3 with 10 minutes left. Right, and Real Madrid managed to tie it in the 80th and send it to overtime. Now, if it goes to PKs, we know who has the goalkeeper that is the PK master, and that's Chelsea. So Real Madrid cannot send this game to PKs. And what do they get? They get like an assist that we've never seen in our lives from Modric. Remember that assist?
Oh, yes.
It was an assist that you had to play like 12 times to like just appreciate. Magical. That's what they needed to advance past the quarterfinals, and they got it. Now they get to the semifinals, and who do they get to play? The favorites, like these are the paper favorites to win the tournament, the best team in the world, City. And City has them by two goals, and injury time hits. This is in the second game. It's the 90th minute. City is up by two goals. And so what does Madrid need? They need to score two goals in injury time to send the game to extras, and they do. Vinicius Jr. scores two goals in a span of 5 minutes to send the game to extra time, where then they won it. And then in the final, they meet Liverpool, and they have their goalkeeper plays his best game of his career, record-setting performance. They needed a record-setting performance by their goalkeeper to win that final. So one-offs, it's something else. But what to have all these things happen in this run, just incredible.
So I historical. Think you have synopsized that run very, very well. But I also feel like in hearing you talk up through that, through all of those knockout stages, the part of that that helps me answers the observation I had last week before the game, which was I just found it weird that all of my Real Madrid fans were all oddly optimistic and all my Liverpool friends were oddly pessimistic. And now it all feels like, well, duh,
right.
look what Real Madrid was doing.
Yep.
And the fact that it happened not once, but twice, now thrice, it went from being one-off, like, oh, they just got lucky, to, oh, no, this is just purely destiny.
Right.
That effing team kind of theory.
Exactly. Right. That's why if it happens in a month-long tournament, it like, our public perception of it is enhanced so much more than how we ultimately looked at it.
Yes. And I will say, I'm certainly not a Liverpool fan, but I am annoyed by people who are outraged, Liverpool fans that are outraged that somehow this was a crummy season for Liverpool. You won two trophies.
Yeah.
I know the quadruple was everybody's, you know, thing. You know, here's the reality. Trebles just aren't for everybody, you know? And certainly quadruples are the impossibility that nobody can achieve. No, seriously, I when I see people bashing on Liverpool because, or Liverpool fans, like other fans of other teams giving them crap, I think is funny.
Yeah.
By the way, did you see the airplane stair truck that they got hidden away at the Liverpool airport? It had the UEFA Champions League trophy with the number 7 on it.
Oh, they had to stash it away.
They had to stash it away.
They didn't cancel the parade.
Either that or they, you know, shipped it off to some Central American country's airport or whatever.
Look, Liverpool, man, what a great, it was a great season.
I wouldn't trade it.
Yes, of course. I wouldn't trade it. It was as frustrating, yes. But, you know, we ran in against a team of destiny, a historical run, and City. You know, twice, 90 points, and you lose to City. What can you do?
When you consider Liverpool's resurgence as a club, are you thankful? This is a genuine question. Are you grateful and thankful that you won the one Premier League title and you won the recent European title? Or are you frustrated that because of these other things, kind of like we talked about last week, those NBA teams that always talk about how, well, we would have won championship if we just hadn't been around during the Jordan years.
Yeah, no, thankful. I wouldn't, obviously thankful for winning the title and winning another Champions League, but you can also be frustrated. Like, man.
They both, yeah.
Yeah, Pep coaching in the league also comes down to that, right?
Yeah.
So the thing about Real Madrid, too, really important. Those four events, four different players. That's Courtois, Benzema, Vinicius Jr., and Modric.
Oh, you mean being difference makers?
Yeah. Difference makers in each of those ties. So, anyway, there you go. Historical run.
Love,
kudos to Madrid.
Love them, hate them. You cannot deny being impressed by their ability to pull that kind of magic. It was, Andy, I think, kudos to you for being so kind. It was a magical season for Madrid. All right, when we come back, we will do America's favorite soccer segment known as The Dribble, next on The Kick Around. Here we are. It's our final segment of the day of this episode of The Kick Around. We'll be back next week at 2 p.m. There's lots of soccer taking place. Some of it means something, some of it doesn't. Lots of UEFA Nations League games are happening as we speak. Italy and Germany are playing against each other, or they've played against each other. That ended up being 1-1. England lost to Hungary earlier today.
Did you see that? Holland, the Netherlands spanked Belgium.
And that's the first time they've beat Belgium in a really long time, too, by the way.
Didn't help that De Bruyne was like, I hate Nations League. I don't even want to play this game. This is their best player saying this. They're like, okay.
That's not helpful. Yeah. Not at all. All right. By the way, don't forget. So the U.S. is playing Uruguay tomorrow, 4 p.m. on Big Boy Fox. That's going to be on Channel 4. We already have the lineup. Berhalter, like he did for the game against Morocco, has already announced his starting 11.
Yeah, why is he doing that way ahead of time? There's something up his sleeve with all this, too.
Maybe. Sean Johnson's going to get the start and goal, which I'm excited to see, because he's actually been in pretty good form for NYCFC.
We didn't talk about Turner game one. I thought excellent.
Yeah. I'm just worried about him not getting him and Zach Steffen not getting regular playing time. Yeah. Yedlin's going to start on the right at fullback. Joe Scally will see again unless Jedi is not able to go. And then Zimmerman and Long will again start as the center back pair, and I think a lot of people are surprised by this. Aaron Long didn't have a terrible game, but he didn't have the best game, and you know, there's lots of silly.
Yeah, Aaron Long, who had to cover for Robinson when they switched.
Miles Robinson is out.
Yeah, no, he had to. Yes, and also for Jedi when they went on possession because Jedi had to push up.
Yeah.
Right. And so
Cannon would pinch in and play right center back. Yeah. Long would play left center back and Zimmerman in the middle.
Right. So that's a little bit of a tactical difference. Maybe Long wasn't comfortable with that.
I don't think he'll play that style. I don't think Berhalter will do that.
Looking at the
game.
Lineup, I don't think, because especially because you got Yedlin now on the right as well.
Well, I think the biggest reason is because of the following, which is who's in the midfield. They don't have Aronson playing. He's essentially got three kind of holding, more like slightly more defensive minded. We're back to MMA again. We've got Musa, Adams, and McKennie. Weston will start the game. We'll only play about 45 minutes. That's good news. Pulisic, Jesus Ferreira, and Tim Weah. By the way, Tim Weah's goal against Morocco.
Yeah.
That's about as hard as you can hit a ball.
Yeah, because that's a good goalkeeper.
That is a fantastic goalkeeper. He didn't have the hand wrist strength to stop that.
Ouch.
That was really good. So that's the starting
11. So that's a 4-3-3. Remember, too, Uruguay, traditionally they play more of the counter, and maybe this is, you know, you realize, okay, you're going to have to play them a little bit differently. Although, I don't know if you saw any of the game against Mexico. I didn't. I read about it. This is how I know. They spanked Mexico 3-0, and Uruguay, from what I read, a new-look Uruguay that actually didn't rely on the counter so much as going forward and keeping the ball and playing that way.
Uruguay has a lot of really good players.
They're a good team.
They are a good team. And you know, we'll see what happens. It's a friendly, but it's a world... I mean, they said this in the Morocco game. They commented, Taylor Twellman... it was like, man, this is being played at a really good pace. This is not your typical friendly.
Yeah.
You can tell these guys are really serious.
Yeah.
So this will be a better and different test than the Morocco game, but it's at 4 p.m. tomorrow against Fox, and we'll talk more about it next week, along with the Nation League games that are coming up over the course of the week for the United States, starting in Austin against Grenada, and then the follow-up game El Salvador. We'll talk about that. All right, let's do America's favorite soccer segment. It is known as the dribble. So if you weren't, well, you probably were confused because you saw Lionel Messi and all of his Argentine buddies celebrating on a field.
With a trophy.
Which looked like Wembley because it was, with a giant trophy like they had just won the World Cup.
And Messi had a second trophy because he won the MVP of the game. And what game is this? Oh my God, I missed it.
And Neymar on social media threw a little shot. Like, what did they do? Win the World Cup? No, they won Finalissima.
Finalissima.
Oh, excuse me.
The Finalissima.
That is not my second language. The Finalissima.
Yes.
Andy, tell everybody what the Finalissima is, please.
The Finalissima is the new
match. They've played it before.
Well, yeah, a while back. This is actually newish. This is CONMEBOL and UEFA getting together, and they're two champions playing each other the next summer. In this case, the champion of Copa America, Argentina, and the champion of The UEFA Europe.
The Euros.
The Euros.
Right.
Italy. And Argentina spanked Italy. 3-0? Was that the final?
I don't remember what the final... It was a... yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
Messi had a great game. Messi's a man on a mission. Messi looks like a... Look. Argentina... I think they're undefeated 35 straight now. They're close to breaking the all-time record for most games, most undefeated game, longest undefeated streak by a national team in history. This is a team that hadn't won a trophy without Maradona strapping the boots till they just won Copa America last year. Messi finally won a trophy with them. This will be Messi's last World Cup. I think this is a team that really is going to... Like, all these big clubs, all these big national teams, they all go try to win the World Cup. It's not like they're going to try more to win this World Cup. But I think it's a team on a mission. And I think Messi feels this is his last, like, he's got to do this.
Yeah, I agree. The part of this story that I really want to focus on, though, Andy, mm-hmm. is the actual, not tournament, but the event itself.
Yeah.
The Finalissima.
Yeah, Finalissima, right.
Because it started back in the 80s as a deal between UEFA and CONMEBOL. In fact, it was called the Artemio Franchi Cup.
Okay.
He was the former UEFA president at the time. And the tournament, it was supposed to be every 4 years. And this is the reason why I think this is something to pay attention to, is UEFA and CONMEBOL working together without FIFA.
Right.
And trying to put these events together, because I don't know if it's like they're thumbing their nose at FIFA or trying to prove that they can put really, really big scale games together.
Well, yeah, it's really an argument against FIFA staging the World Cup every 2 years.
Well, it is now, because the original version of this only happened twice.
Yep.
And then they abandoned it. The fact that they brought it back, I think, lends to your suggestion that these two confederations are like, we don't want the World Cup every 2 years.
Yeah.
Because we can do our own thing if we need to do that.
Right, and FIFA goes, oh, yeah, what are you going to do? And what are they going to do? What are they talking about doing?
Well, so the thing that I don't know where it officially is at this moment, but I know that there has been discussed as recently as the beginning of this year that the next UEFA Nations League tournament, starting in 23-24,
right.
I think,
yes.
will not only be your typical UEFA lineup of European nations, but they will invite Argentina and Brazil from CONMEBOL.
And four other ones
to participate in that tournament.
Yeah, so essentially a World Cup. A European South American World Cup.
Yes.
Event. And they're saying...
And FIFA can do nothing about it.
Right. Because they're confederation-level events. If this takes the place of the Nations Cup tournament, I think it'll drum up more interest. Because I think interest for Nations Cup games, whether they're in Europe or in the CONCACAF region, are kind of... Right? Teams playing because they have to and because it affects their rankings. South America currently, CONMEBOL, they don't have a Nations League tournament. The way FIFA wants to plan for a World Cup every 2 years would severely affect the ability to schedule Copa America and the Euros. And if you have the Nations League also having to be scheduled, that's really going to complicate things. So what UEFA and CONMEBOL are doing, they're striking up a friendship, it's actually now they signed a formal letter of intent to go forward with something like this to kind of send the message to FIFA that maybe you should just stick to what you do, the every 4 year World Cup, and let us have the other 2 years, like the every other year tournament.
All right. So when you think about, I guess I'm wondering where we're headed in terms of the ultimate control and power situation that FIFA has historically always had over the sport. Mm-hmm. Because when you think about this and the Super League thing, like how much was FIFA involved with the Super League situation?
ultimately, I don't think FIFA was all they had opinion, but they ultimately didn't get that involved in all of that.
Right. So that's why I'm asking, like,
because that's at a club level.
These types of things are starting to pop up, and I'm wondering if we're getting into a world and a universe and a future where maybe FIFA just isn't the center of everything in the way that
maybe,
it always has.
So
been.
The way FIFA has been able to rule is because they have the vote. They have the African votes and the Asian votes and the votes of the teams in the Caribbean. And when you add all those up, they outvote Europe and South America. Now, what South America has done, CONMEBOL, now they've turned to Mexico and the U.S. and they said, "Hey, how about some of your teams, MLS and Liga MX, playing in the Copa Libertadores?" So they're also trying,
which is their kind of Champions
League,
right?
Yes, and CONCACAF and CONMEBOL have also put on a joint tournament, the Copa Centenario, that went very well, a huge moneymaker. So that relationship is starting to get stronger. So UEFA, CONMEBOL, and now CONCACAF are starting to do things on their own. And the more you see of this, the weaker FIFA gets, and all they have then are Africa and Asia, big confederations, lots of countries. But ultimately, what the world wants to see, if there's a World Cup, is all nations from all parts of the world represented. And if FIFA can't pull that off every 2 years, they're not going to do it. And this is where this is headed. So I'm in favor of anything. I would rather things stay at a World Cup every 4 years. Are you in that camp too?
Yes, I do not want a World Cup every 2 years.
I prefer that. I think it's more special that way.
And I don't want it with a jillion nations. I want the World Cup.
We're
going to
get that
here
in 2026. We're going to get 48.
I know.
But let's not grow it from that. Let's keep it at 48. Okay. And let's keep it every 4 years.
Andy, when are we getting our World Cup 2026 venue announcement?
The 16th of June, good sir.
Okay. We're getting a final, right? We're getting the final here
on the
in
16th
Dallas?
Of June. We're just going to find out which cities in the U.S. will host games.
You're not
helping. That's all we're finding out.
All right, last thing before we go. Did you see the sad announcement of the retirement of the great Carlos Tevez?
Yes, indeed.
Did you see what the last goal he scored was?
No, was it
scored
in China or somewhere?
No,
oh, okay.
It was down in no, it was for Boca Juniors against River Plate.
In a real game?
In a real game.
I didn't see that in the Clásico, and that he decided, okay, I'm hanging it up right after? No.
I think I saw that correctly, yeah.
Yeah, one of the greats of the game, you know. Played for your boys, too.
Played for United. Yeah the whole City. Drama about him. Who was he? I guess he was playing for West Ham and then went to United. What was the story?
West Ham, yeah. He had good years at West Ham.
Yeah, and then he left, and then he went to City and had that whole situation over there. That was crazy. He's such an interesting character. Played with such spunk, Andy. I'm going to use the word spunk. He was a spunky player.
He scored. He bagged a lot of goals.
Yeah,
is what
he scored some bangers for sure. And he had those crazy scars. Is it the document? Wasn't there a really good documentary we watched, by the way, about him?
I
think there's a Carlos Tevez documentary on Netflix or Prime or something. Because I remember watching it and them telling the story about where he got the scars.
Yeah, no, I don't remember. I didn't see it.
Yeah, there's one.
It's
called Apache, The Life of Carlos Tevez.
Yes.
So you saw that?
Yes.
You recommend it?
Yes. It's very good.
Juve, too. He scored 39 goals in 66 games for Juve. That's...
Sam, did you say it's on Netflix, Apache?
It sure is. Came out in 2019.
Yeah, if you haven't seen that, that's worth a spin for sure.
39 goals in 66 games when he played at Juve.
Wow. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Well, he's announced his retirement officially. He's not going to end up coming to MLS. By the way, Chiellini is signing a deal with LAFC at the age of 30 kabillion years
he's
old.
He's fun. You know how good he is? Oh, he'll be, you know, it's one position where you can afford to be that age if you have cover playing with you, right?
Yeah, I suppose. No. I suppose.
You're anti the signing?
Yeah. No, I just, I don't know. Look, Chiellini's one of those guys that I want to play. I want to be able to see him play, and I'm going to get to do that now.
Fun personality.
But I do also, at the same time, am conflicted with the league
as
MLS signing retirement guys.
As long as it's not the only thing or the prevalent thing, as long as it's mixed in with a lot of other good signings, it's okay.
Yeah. You know, Andy, you and I lied. There is one more thing. You were not here the weekend. I think Tyler was here for you the weekend that the big... player agreement, U.S. women's and men's equal pay agreement.
Yeah, yes. It was a Hall of Fame weekend.
That's why you were out. Yep. By the way, did you see Walker Zimmerman's announcement this week that he may be the first to take up one of the new parts of that agreement?
No, what do you mean by take up one of the parts? Because he was the leading voice for the men.
He was. Yep. So Walker, in an interview earlier this week, Walker and his wife recently had a baby.
Okay.
And so Walker, in this new deal, the men for the first time are going to get daycare rights and parental care rights.
As part of the concession.
As part of the concessions that the women have already had. Yeah. The men are getting them too. So he talked about bringing his kid to camp and using all of the new services available to the players.
Excellent.
So his wife can have some downtime.
Nice.
So good for Walker.
Yeah. He plays for Nashville, right? So does that extend to MLS or just with the national team?
Because he's with the national team.
Yeah, it's just with the national team.
Right,
yeah.
So
okay.
He's going to bring the baby with him, hang out wherever they're traveling to, and use the Federation's babysitter.
Yeah, there you
go. So mommy can have some mommy time.
Got to earn back some of that money, some of that bonus money, as they call it around here.
All right. There you go. There goes another episode of America's favorite soccer segment known as The Dribble.
Did we kill another 2 hours?
Man, look at us burning ticket 2 hours like nobody's business. We are absolute pros at that, Andrew. All right, don't forget, U.S.-Uruguay. I know it's a friendly, but it is going to be one to watch and discuss, and we'll talk more about it. That's at 4 o'clock tomorrow on Fox. Ukraine and Wales happens at 11 on ESPN. That's a big one, too. Don't forget either one of those games. Anything else, Andy, real quick?
No, I'm just go Ukraine. Can't believe you're going to root for Wales, but okay.
I have no heart. All right. Thank you to Sam for all his producing. Good producer, Sam. Good producer. And EA, good for board operating skills at a very high level. And P1s, you know it. We love and adore you. Why don't you go on out there, get stuck in, and win your 50s.
And here's my sperm.